What is going on, everyone? It is another edition of One on One with John Alba here on adfreeshows.com, coming to you every single Thursday. If you're an ad-free show subscriber, you get early access to all of our one-on-one interviews, plus all the iotas of bonus content that we have here on Conrad Thompson's AFS network. But we also drop it every Thursday night, 7 p.m. AFS on YouTube.com. Last week, we had Ricardo Rodriguez, your personal favorite ring announcer. So I was like, okay, how can we keep this announcer vibe going? Well, this guy right here, he's one of my favorites out there today. And I think he and I have a lot in common, and I'm going to be very excited to dive into it with the one and only Ian Riccaboni here on One on One. What's going on, man?
Hey, John, not too much. You know, it's we're wrapping up Christmas here at the house and we're heading into New Year's, and it's an amazing time of year. We have two little ones, so it's been hectic. They've had their quote unquote winter break from daycare, which was a lot of fun. Played with a lot of toys that Santa Claus brought, but it's we're winding down and the calendar's turning over. So I'm excited for a new year and a lot of new and interesting opportunities.
It is such a weird time to be in broadcasting right now. And that's dating back all the way to March of 2020, obviously. But then with everything that has gone on with Ring of Honor on your end, and now you're faced with adapting and pivoting like a lot of us have had to. And it almost feels like it's reflective of the way the industry is going, where you constantly have to be pivoting in one direction or another. How has that experience been for you so far?
Yeah, it's been interesting. I tweeted something when we first found out about the hiatus that I didn't know if I was ready to do anything else. In my life, there was always kind of these lifers. There was Tony Schiavone in WCW. There's Joey Styles in ECW, Gorilla and Bobby in WWF, and even Vince McMahon. You know, before I knew he was the owner, he was an announcer for the entirety of my childhood. So, you know, there were these folks that you just associated with the companies, even a little bit more so than some of the wrestlers, because you see the wrestlers kind of move back and forth a little bit, but you rarely saw the broadcasters go anywhere. And so it always felt to me like, man, I might have lucked into something. I might have fallen backwards into being the person associated with Ring of Honor. This would have been my eighth year, and it still might be, fingers crossed. Would have been my sixth year, heading into my sixth year as the host and as the play-by-play guy for Ring of Honor. And so I never took that for granted. Very few people get more than 6 months or a year to really see if they're good and to really cut their teeth. And I got an opportunity when Kevin Kelly left to pursue New Japan and do those Japanese events. So for me, it was not lost on me what kind of gift I was given. I'd been the B-team announcer, the YouTube announcer for Ring of Honor for years at that point, for 2.5 years. And it wasn't a guarantee that it was going to come to me. I know they had talked to other people, some of the people that I just mentioned that they had talked to and reached out to. So I really had to earn it and really work as hard as I could to get as good as I could, as quick as I could. For me now, heading into 2022, that comfort's gone a little bit. I was lucky that Kevin Kelly in particular, he's become a big part of my life. He's heading to Japan for an extended period of time. So they need someone to call New Japan strong. So I've been very lucky that first opportunity that I'm going to have outside the walls of Ring of Honor is going to come in New Japan, where I'm familiar with a lot of the talent. There's a lot of talent that I've either called matches before or have done so in Ring of Honor. So I'm super excited about that. And then, you know, as Ring of Honor was headed toward a hiatus, we had started to work with GCW, and we had the GCW Tag Team Champions in. And then we had Effie and AJ Gray challenge the Briscoes for the GCW tag team titles on one of our programs. And I don't think it's any secret to anybody that watched GCW or that watched Ring of Honor that there was going to be more of that. And so as a consequence of that, Jonathan Gresham is defending the world championship there. He's defending it in Impact. He's defending it in GCW. And for GCW, I'm going to be there in the Hammerstein, a building I'm super familiar with. I love with all my heart. And I've been on the previous record-setting event there, which was the Ring of Honor New Japan show. And I get to be there as part of an amazing effort with the GCW crew that will break the record for attendance and gate and whatnot. So that's pretty cool. Those are the things right in front of me. But like I've mentioned before, you know, I have had that kind of comfort for a long time of, okay, I have a contract. I have this, I have that. I can expect to do X amount of dates or go to this amount of Ring of Honor tapings or bubbles or what have you. That comfort's kind of gone. So I've been very flattered that New Japan has reached out, that GCW's reached out, that maybe some other opportunities have reached out as well. And I'm just kind of looking to play it by ear. This is kind of, there's an expression, I'm from Allentown, and we have a lot of Pennsylvania Dutch and Pennsylvania German folks in Lancaster, which is not too far away. There's an expression and the term called rumspringa, which is when Amish folks are able to leave, temporarily physically leave either Lancaster or wherever they're from, and enjoy some of the things that they're not used to enjoying. And then they can decide to come back and see which life was for them. I've made no secret. I'd love to stay with Ring of Honor. I think I fully intend to stay there, but I've been getting some interesting quote unquote permission granted along the ways. Ones that I didn't think in a normal circumstance I'd get to do. So I'm thankful for that. And I'm thankful for A, the people reaching out, and B, for Ring of Honor for giving me the permission to do a lot of these things.
A little teasery there. There's a lot to unpack in everything you just said, but I love it. And I have found in broadcasting that it is very much, and like, this is going to sound cliche, but it's so the truth. And especially if you've worked in broadcasting, you know, it's the truth. Everything is about right place, right time. Every single transformative thing that will happen in your career as a broadcaster is about being in the right place at the right time. I got my gig on the news station in Orlando because I was at the AFC Championship game in New England, and the guy behind me at the media buffet line was looking for talent to hire. If he had been two people behind me, my career would have been drastically different. My life would have been drastically different. And it seems like you're going through a similar thing right now. And we talk about the journey a lot here on One-on-One. I think it's the most important thing that any of us go through, and your journey is very similar to mine. So where do you fall in love at the point in your life with the idea of broadcasting? Because it's a very much romanticized career path.
So John, I'll take you back to the first time I can remember kind of falling in love with wrestling. And this was, I remember being at my neighbor's. I grew up in a trailer park. I was born in a trailer, and we had elderly neighbors, Pat, Spot, and her husband. And Pat would always look for different things for me to do. And I was a mama's boy from the time I was born until 3 years old. And I missed her, and I'd yell and I'd cry and I'd scream. She'd go to work at McDonald's, and it'd cause a fuss. But when her husband came home, that was when he put on wrestling, and I just calmed down. it just worked. You know, my brother's 8 years older. He had wrestling magazines, you know, all over the house, and he was right there for the Hulkamania, the Rock and Wrestling, all that. So I would kind of grew up immersed by it, whether it was the folks babysitting me, whether it was the folks like my brother or my parents. My parents kind of nurtured and indulged it because that was something I really liked to do. As time went on, our socioeconomic status improved. You know, we moved into a nice house. We started to have a little bit extra money. I got to go to the wrestling events, and there was lots of them in Allentown, Bethlehem, Easton, the Lehigh Valley. So for me as a kid, there was really no moment that hooked me, but just the constant, you know, seeing wrestling as kind of a calming factor in my life. It's always been this weird center. I have pretty bad anxiety. I have obsessive compulsive disorder. The one thing that can recenter me is just watching wrestling. For whatever reason, it just calms me down. It's a little mindless. It's a little fun. You still got to think about it a little bit. You still got to kind of focus some of your energy toward it. But that's always been something in my life that's always just been there and has been really fun to me. I like the big muscle guys. This is going to sound weird. I like the warlord. I liked Hercules. I liked anybody that was huge and jacked. The Ultimate Warrior, obviously. And then like Sting and Sid and WCW, and the Road Warriors, Legion of Doom. But I wouldn't, there wasn't a moment I could find, but when I look back, I see pictures of me with the action figures. I always had the action figures or pictures of me with the magazines. And that lasted pretty much through middle school and high school. It's interesting, you know, I kept up with it, but that's when you start to get into girls and it was weird because when we were in high school, you know, girls or guys, and we were in high school, for me, it was right when wrestling was falling out of favor. We had that big boom, and then everybody's kind of like, all right, I'm done with it. And I was the wrestling guy. So in fifth and sixth grade, when wrestling was exploding, everybody's like, oh, who's Diamond Dallas Page? Who's Scott Hall? Who's, should I know who Steve Austin is? Who's this? Who's that? And I was the guy that, you know, my friends came to. But then by ninth and 10th grade, it was kind of like, oh, you're still into that wrestling stuff. So it was an interesting path from there, but I always stayed connected to it. One of my best friends in high school, Chris Freed, he does a lot of stand-up comedy. He's frequently on some of the, we're polar opposites, but we're best friends. He's frequently a contributor on Fox News as like a comedian, and I'm the complete opposite, but it's hilarious because we're inseparable. Over the years, and he was doing a high school film project. We went to the Wild Samoans Training Center, and you know, I'm 6 feet tall. I'd always been around 200 pounds, a decent athlete. I played baseball in college, so I thought, man, you know, I might be able to do this wrestling thing. And I'm 17 years old, so I got all the chutzpah in the world. And Atha tells me, hey, you're a big guy, you look athletic. Why don't you try and land on your back, take a back bump, and I did, and I took my chin, but I didn't exhale, knocked the wind out of myself. And that right there was when I knew, you know what? Maybe the broadcasting thing is a little bit safer. It's a little less dangerous.
Just a little bit. And I see I've made the mistake of doing the broadcasting thing and getting into bumping, which is just not advised for anyone. I mean, it's so funny. Okay, so here's actually a really good story. So I worked a match this past September, and when we were going through planning the match, the high spot that I was going to do an elbow drop. And I mean, the idea of 5'10", 150 pounds, soaking wet John Alba flying off the top rope is just, it's insanity. But I practice and practice and practice, and I couldn't get it right. I couldn't do it right. So I called up mutual friend of ours, my co-host on Up for Debate here on Ad Free Shows, Danny Cage. And I was like, Danny, help me out here. What can I be doing? And he goes, well, just watch Ian Riccoboni do an elbow drop. And so I cue you up doing your elbow drop over Tommy Dreamer. And I must have studied it 45 times just watching it, because it was a civilian doing an elbow drop, which is what I should have looked like doing an elbow drop. And then an hour before the match started, they cut the spot from the match. So it didn't even end up mattering at the end of the day. But it's so funny. Our journeys, man, are so parallel, because, you know, you talk about that going up, watching wrestling, or it's not super cool and everything. But at the heart, you're a broadcaster. You're multifaceted. I know you love baseball. I love baseball. I worked at MLB Network. You did stuff with the Phillies and whatnot. So how does that shape your broadcasting path? Was that what you initially intended to do, get in the sports broadcasting side of things?
Yeah, 100%. And it's so weird because to me, I always kind of looked at it, I kind of have a math brain, and I kind of looked at it from an actuarial standpoint of, at the time I came out of college, there was two shows on TV, two wrestling shows. There was WWE and there was Impact. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to be a wrestling broadcaster, you would either have to displace Jim Ross, or you'd have to displace Michael Cole, or you'd have to displace or Mike Tenay. And all three of those folks are either still on TV or had at least 10 more years on television. So I knew there was kind of this A-list, top of the top wrestling class. So For me, it was always just, okay, wrestling's great. I love, I'll keep watching it. I'll keep, I'll go to the local shows, live events. It'll be tons of fun. That'll be my thing with Chris. And then, my wife I met my wife in college. She got into it a little bit just for the fun and the show of it. So it was good. It was kind of like just a fun thing. But for baseball, there's the radio guy, there's the TV guy, there's the guy in the crowd, there's the guy, there's the player interview, there's everything. And then there's podcasts and videos, and those were booming by 2011, 12, 13, and then video. So what we did, we had a blog, philliesnation.com. I was out of college for maybe 2 years, and I was writing on it, and one of our guys, Pat Gallen, became an Emmy-winning broadcaster for CBS 3 in Philly. And he had a friend who did production that he met in college. And they did this really cool, simple, but really shot professionally web blog on the Phillies. And they did it once a week, and it was about 10 minutes, and it looked really sharp. And I had done a public access show with my friend Chris, who, we did this show, and it was kind of dumb and campy, but we met this guy, Ryan Kelly, who he's actually important now, and we can talk about that at the end. But this guy, Ryan Kelly, was like, yeah, like, what do you need? I said, hey, we have this web log, like we're doing this vlog, this video log that we think we could put on TV. Like, we don't want to insult you, Service Electric Cable, but we think this is better than what's currently on public access. And we gave him a hard sell. And he watched it and he said, great. And they started to put it on before every Iron Pigs game on Tuesday nights at 6:30. So soon enough, we're producing this, 30-minute show week after week. Then Comcast Sportsnet and now CBS Philly or NBC Philly, excuse me, they pick it up. So then it becomes like a paid thing. Before we were just kind of doing it for fun. We were just trying to get some TV experience. So I had thought my early experience indicated that, hey, wait a minute, this baseball thing, like there's some life to this. Like I was able to do it. And then I was starting to get credentialed and I was doing the press stuff and I was doing graphic work for the Phillies. I was doing different things with the Phillies. And I was kind of getting in that circle. And I started to get in the circle with the Iron Pigs too, the AAA team. So I thought, there's so many opportunities within an hour and a half of my house, whether it's the Reading Phillies, whether it's the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs, whether it's the Phillies themselves. And then there's the Trenton Thunder, there's the Wilmington Blue Rocks. There's just so many baseball things. It's like, well, I could just do something like this. And I was going down that path. And then I met Danny Cage in the Blue Meanie. And I went there and I was doing a segment on famous Phillies fans. We had recorded stuff with Mark Summers, with Tony Luke, with a bunch of different people. And I reached out to Meanie and I said, hey, Meanie, I know you're a big Phillies fan. We'd love to have you on the show, do a 5-minute segment. And I said, can you pick me up? And I had a little 2003 Hyundai Accent, which is probably the smallest car available on the market. So there's me, 6 feet, 225 pounds, and there's Meanie, 6'2", and
More than 200 pounds, yeah.
we're crammed shoulder to shoulder in this little car, and we pull up, and I meet Danny for the first time, and I could tell I was getting the bug because I got the same feeling, I have the same feeling, and if you get this feeling, you know it when you walk into a baseball stadium and you see the diamond, or when you walk into a wrestling event and you see the ring, and it's just that feeling of wow, like this is the place. And when I walked into the Monster Factory, I think you've been there, John. It's a nice facility. They do it really well for the local folks. It's a great place to train. It's got all kinds of weights, the amateur mats, the two rings, everything you need, but it's not a place to somebody who's not a wrestling fan that I think you get that reaction
They
from.
wouldn't romanticize it, no.
Right. But if that was your thing, your eyes would pop out of your head and you'd get that feeling. So I left there feeling pretty good about the segment we did with Meanie. I got Danny's business card. I gave him mine. And then I cold called him like 2 weeks later. I said, hey, Dan, it was really great to meet you. If my buddy ever wanted to do wrestling commentating or announcing, what would my buddy do? What would my friend do? And he goes, tell your friend to show up this Saturday with a suit, be there at 1 p.m., learn how to set up and break down the ring. And he gave me very, very explicit advice, very explicit directions. And for every instruction or direction he gave me, I followed it. And there was you know, there was a Kevin Kelly seminar that he brought in Kevin Kelly, and he said, on the poster, it said wrestlers only, you know, no refs, no managers, no nothing, wrestlers only. And I said, well, I guess I won't be making that one. And he goes, no, you doofus. I said that so you'd be the only one he'd see. So, I mean, he's really looked out for me over the years and, you know, really put me in positions to succeed. But same kind of thing, you know, like you mentioned, if somebody didn't turn around and see you or see you in that line, if I didn't get up, you know, if I didn't wear a full on suit, you know, and be with the wrestlers that were at this camp, which included Damian Priest, which included Donovan Dijak, which included, you know, WWE names out the wazoo, Ring of Honor names out the wazoo, all these years later, LSG, Shaheem Ali, all these different folks. If I didn't put myself in that position, who knows what would have happened? And I could have very well gotten there, and Kevin could have said, hey, didn't you read the sign, Dumbo? It says, you know, wrestlers only. But he didn't. He said, hey, why are you in a suit? Stand up and sell me tickets for tonight's event. And I did a minute. I hit the time cue. And then he noticed I was smiley. So he said, hey, you got 30 seconds to convey the saddest news you ever heard. And there was a wrestler named Red Scorpion. And I said that he fractured his exoskeleton and he wouldn't be able to compete that night. And so, I mean, we just had fun with it. And I just tried to make the most of every opportunity, but for sure, I wanted to do sports. Like I'm super happy that I landed with wrestling, because I think deep down that's what I wanted to do, but I thought I'd have better odds getting into baseball because more opportunities.
You don't view it as a viable path, and that it's, I'm telling you, man, our journeys are so similar because I was such the same way going through college, getting out of it, working for an MLB network. Then I went the local sports route, you know, sports director at an affiliate, sports reporter at an affiliate, and wrestling was always in my periphery and getting involved with it. But then it was, okay, wait a minute. I think I can make this a full-time career. And it takes a lot, as you said the word before, chutzpah. It takes a lot of chutzpah to take that leap of faith. In your opinion, why is it worth someone taking that leap of faith and betting on themselves? Because that's what you did. That's what I did. We bet on ourselves. Why is it worth it?
Yeah, there's a lot to be said about doing something that's just for you. And I was lucky. I'm sorry about that, John. I'm using a brand new headset. And so I picked today to use it. It's a Christmas gift. It's wonderful, but I'm having Bluetooth in and out. But I was so lucky because it's always good to do something for yourself. And going to college and having that little voice in the back of your head that says, I'm doing this because I really want to try and do this. You know, you're really going to be disappointed with yourself if you don't make your best effort to try and do that thing that you've wanted to do when you were a teenager, or when you were 5 years old, or whenever you figured out that's the thing you wanted to do. And if you don't try your best, you don't always have to get there. But my dad played guitar for a lot of club bands and a lot of local bands in the 70s and 80s. And he opened up for Todd Rundgren, for Head East, for Rick Derringer. There's another accidental wrestling tie. But to me, he gave it his best. And he's told me the first time I can remember, I have a great dad, but he's not a lovey-dovey dad. He's the best dad in the world. But he doesn't usually use the word proud. And the first time he told me he was proud of me was my first tour of the UK. And when I came home, we picked up our son. They helped babysit our son, Zach, at the time. And he pulled me aside and he goes, man, I'm really proud of you. Like when I was playing music, when I was playing guitar, you know, we did some cool stuff, but I really wanted to see the world and I really wanted to see different things, and you made it happen. And to me, that was so cool because I did what made me proud, but it was also, you know, I have such a supportive wife. I have such a supportive family that there was this added bonus of they knew, I think, what I wanted more than I knew what I wanted. And they could see me going down this road and they could tell how much it would mean to me if I got there. And so I have the biggest group of cheerleaders around me. You know, it just, you know, between my wife, my family, I have a bunch of friends who I used to watch wrestling with in high school that I've talked about a little bit, that, you know, they follow the events, and it's amazing. So, you know, for me, that's why it's worth it, because you're doing all of these things, whether you realize it or not, to try and get to what you think will make you the happiest. And even if you don't get there, it's worth it. I had a goal to call one match at the Monster Factory. That's what I wanted to do. That's how all this started. I wanted to get good enough and Danny to trust me enough so that I could call one match. And then my next goal was, okay, I want to try and call a whole event. I want to do the whole event and then see what happens. And then I met Kevin. Maybe I could do an internet match. You know, maybe I could do one of those internet exclusives they post. Okay. Maybe I could do a live event that goes to DVD, and then maybe I could do a TV, and then maybe I could do a pay-per-view. And then, wow, man, that's interesting. Maybe if Kevin leaves in a couple of years, maybe he'll give me a shot. And so it starts to feel more real as you do different things. But if you have attainable goals, you know, you'll be surprised how quickly you can meet some of them and how satisfying things are. I mean, had I just called one match at the Monster Factory, I think I would have been okay. Like if it would have ended right there, that's a reputable school. They good products. I mean, I got to call Matt Riddle's first match ever. I got to call a ton of Damian Priest matches. You know, if everything would have stopped right there, that would have been a cool story, and I would have been all right with that. That would have satisfied a lot of my dream. But then as you hit those goals and you do them and you get constructive feedback on how to get better, and you feel yourself getting better because of the people that care about you around you, whether it's Danny or Kevin Kelly or Delirious at Ring of Honor, who's really helped me become a better commentator. You know, you start to get a little greedy, but you also get a little hungry. You know, why can't I do more? Why can't I, you know, chase this down even further? So that to me has been sort of the biggest reason you should bet on yourself, because number one, I think you'll surprise yourself. Number two, I think it's worth trying to make yourself happy, even if you fall a little short.
Well, and it's that ideology. You and I share a love for Bruce Springsteen as well. It's the last line of Born to Run. Someday, girl, I don't know when we're going to get to that place where we really want to go. You don't know when you're going to get there. You stay on the chase, you're going to get there. And I try to live by that ideology very much. So we'll talk Bruce at the end of this, because I need to talk Bruce with you. But we talk wrestling psychology a lot here with a lot of the wrestling talent we have, but I want to talk broadcasting psychology, because there's very much psychology to broadcasting. So in your opinion, Ian Riccaboni, what makes a great play-by-play broadcaster, regardless of the sport?
Yeah, the best play-by-play announcer can break things down into digestible pieces, not talking down to fans that follow every week or every game, but also engages those that might be new to the product or new to the sport, and is able to really cross those fan bases. And so for me, you know, I always remind myself, this might be someone's first time watching this program. This might be someone's first time watching the show. And I always try and remind myself, there might be somebody out there who's seen even more Ring of Honor than I have, which I haven't seen everything. It's possible that, you know, somebody has been a fan and seen literally every DVD and every TV episode from start to finish, and something that I haven't done. So, you know, I always try and blend those two worlds. I always try and assume there's two ends, and I try and meet those fans in the middle. And to me, it's also about building a good rapport and being conversational. The teams that I like the most, Harry Callis and Richie Ashburn, you have Scott Fransky and Larry Anderson, who are the Phillies radio team, who I think are, you know, I'm very biased, but I love listening to them. They have great chemistry. They make it sound like a conversation. Scott Fransky, he's just kind of like a dad that you get the impression that he knows what he's talking about, but he's not talking down to you. He's got the gravitas. He's willing to have a little fun, but if it's a tight game in the bottom of the ninth and you're sweating bullets that, you know, Brad Lidge is going to close out the World Series, then he brings you there too. And he gets you that anticipation, and he builds on the energy that you're already feeling. And I think that's really key. There's key moments in different matches where the play-by-play's job should be kind of dictating and guiding the emotions that you're feeling. And it, you know, if the action picks up, you should follow the action. If the action slows down, let it breathe and just let the moment simmer and really pick up on what the crowd's doing and the energy of what's involved. You could do a million moves, but you've talked about with other guests, the psychology of it is what matters. You know, you can punch somebody in the face 30 times, but is that a great story? Yeah, it might be, depending on, you know, is it revenge? Is it something? If it's supposed to be a technical match between Jonathan Gresham and Jay Lethal, and Jay Lethal gets punched in the face 30 times by Gresham, probably not the right story. So you really, for me, a great play-by-play announcer in any sport is conversational, can break the game down into the most simplest ways, but give that extra, that extra piece of cheese or candy to the longtime fans and make sure they still feel welcome as well. And then really just find a good relationship with their partner. And that, I think, I love Colt, but I think Caprice Coleman and I really, really found something special. We found a groove in the bubble TV era of Ring of Honor, and then our last couple of live events. So I was really fortunate over the years to have two just phenomenal partners in Colt and Caprice. Yeah. And I really couldn't ask for anyone better.
Well, and what a lot of people don't understand with play-by-play too, as far as wrestling is concerned, because I mean, I've done play-by-play on ESPN, on Fox Sports for real sports, baseball, basketball, football. The element that is different with wrestling is you are trying to convey a story while you're also calling action. And it is a really hard thing to do those first few times of trying it. It's really difficult because you're so used to, when you're calling real sports, you're telling the story of the game. There's no doubt about that, but there are no talking points. Okay, we need to get this across. You're like, it's very, very different. And a lot of people don't understand that. And we saw recently this past year in WWE with Adnan Virk, who is an outstanding broadcaster, didn't have a successful transition into calling wrestling because it's just so different. And was that something that took a little bit of an adjustment for you going from traditional sports to this arena?
Yeah, I'm a big bass guitar player. And, you know, my family, were very musically inclined. I think my dad did it on purpose. He played the guitar. He taught my brother the drums, and my brother picked up the drums.
You're starting a band. Okay. Bass. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So, okay. But with the bass, you can learn the bass in 20 minutes. I'm fully convinced of that. You can play along with most major rock songs. Maybe not 20 minutes, maybe an hour, right? If you hand somebody, okay, this is what you do, this is what. It'll sound mechanical, but is it technically proficient? Yes.
I've seen School of Rock. I know how they do it. Turn it sideways too low, you got a bass. Yep. Okay.
Yeah. So wrestling broadcasting to me is a lot of the same, where if you put somebody in the booth with a headset on and you ask them, hey, call this match, it's a lot like the bass guitar, because you can get somebody that's going to call a headlock or a hammerlock or a powerbomb or a power slam. And that will be correct, not unlike the person you've just taught the bass guitar. But when you get good, when you get to Gary Talent of the E Street Band, when you get to Stanley Clark, one of the great jazz bassists of all time, Rick Danko of the band, Rick Danko isn't really playing anything that's difficult, but he's got some soul and he's got some energy to it. You know, same thing with Gary Talent. Stanley Clark is playing, you know, he is playing things that are difficult, but he also has energy to it. Kerry Silkin and I, is a great friend of mine, former owner of Ring of Honor. We go back and forth. He loves Jethro Tull. Jethro Tull, to me, even though they're doing things in different time signatures and key signatures and this and that, it's mechanical to me. I don't feel them. I feel Gary Talent. I feel Rick Danko. I feel Stanley Clark. I feel Stefan Lessard. You know, people used to bag on Dave Matthews Band, but I feel Stefan Lessard as a bassist. I feel what he's doing. And again, it's not mechanically complicated, but there's emotion behind it. And I think that's the same with wrestling commentary, where you can have somebody do play-by-play. They could be technically proficient. But as I learned firsthand, until you get hundreds of matches, that's when you start to be able to put your brand on it, and not my catchphrase or my sign off, but just how I would interact in real life if my kid threw a fit, how I'd act in real life if my kids did something wonderful. Getting those raw emotions out of something that doesn't naturally.
How do you know when you find your voice, Ian, as a broadcaster? Because I struggled for the first 6 years of my career to find my voice as a broadcaster. It takes a while. And with pro wrestling play-by-play especially, you have people who are super loud and in your face yelling at every single power move that happens, or someone gets thrown in a side headlock and they're screaming. Or there's no emotion at all with some people, and you see someone do an outstanding 450 splash and there's nothing to it. So how do you find that right voice?
Yeah, part of it to me, you know, we talked earlier about doing the New Japan Strong tapings coming up. I have rewatched, I'm working on rewatching every single episode of New Japan Strong. Thankfully, at this point, there's 72 or 71. So I'm almost there. But to me, it's knowing and anticipating moves. It's knowing and anticipating strategy. If you treat it almost like a real sport, if you treat it less like entertainment and more like, man, this guy really likes to do a power slam, or this guy really likes to telegraph when he's about to do this move by raising his arm and yelling, or you can start to get yourself hyped up and yourself excited, where there are certain ticks and certain movements that are even blind to some of the wrestlers, that you can manufacture something. I don't want to say out of nothing, but you can take the information that's around you and help to build a compelling story. So that's, you know, that's sort of how I look at it. And to me, you know, I want the fans to be excited when the finishing moves happen. I want the fans to believe like I am, and believe me when I think it's over. You know, if somebody hits a finishing move, or if somebody's won with this move 20 times, I want them to think with me, hey, this is it. This is done. And I'm going to give you the information as they're walking down the ring. Hey, you got to watch out for the octopus stretch. Jonathan Gresham, anytime he's locked it in his last seven matches, has won with the move. If he gets lethal, it's over. Those little things to plant those seeds, because throughout the match, you can make them grow. And the most effective commentators to me are the ones that hit you subtly, that they might be looking to do this. And they might lay out their own kind of hypothetical game plan right in the beginning. And then you're either a genius if it happens, or, hey, the wrestler's a genius. He's outsmarted us. He knows that his opponent may have done the same thing that we just tried to do. Man, and his opponent's smart too, because his opponent's adapting on the fly here. So I try and treat it as honestly as much like UFC as possible, where I go back and I literally watch tape of what guys are doing. And I try and figure out, okay, when Jonathan Gresham looks for the octopus, what does he do first? Or when Bandito hits the 21 plex, what's the most common way he gets into it? And how do I know that might be coming? And how do I set up the fans to have that anticipation? It's like when Bruce plays 10th Avenue Freeze Out and he does the big break in the middle, and you know, and he's going through the band and this and that. And by the end, everybody knows he's going to Clarence. Everybody in the building knows he's going to Clarence. And that's the way, to me, in certain matches, you should build up to a finishing move, where it's, you know, not every match, because then when you do that and you break it, it's even cooler, because, oh, I thought he was going to meant you go to Clarence, but this time it's Valentine's Day, so he went to Patty Scalfa, or this time it's, you know, it's it was Roy Bittan's birthday, so he went to Roy. So that's the kind of stuff where I don't want to say you want to telegraph it or choreograph it, but if you can start to pick up on these little nuances that are happening that might be blind and just kind of transparent to everybody, you could tell a really interesting story out of what's happening and help build that anticipation. And that's, to me, that's the key. That's why the crowd responds. You know, there's, I watched a Wrestle Kingdom from 1994. It was 1994. It was Road Warrior Hawk, Kensuke Sasaki, the Power Warriors versus Hercules Hernandez and Scott Norton. And when I tell you the biggest reaction that a move got was a power slam by Kensuke Sasaki onto Hercules, And meanwhile, in other matches, there's people killing each other. But the biggest reaction of the whole night was the power slam. It's because it meant something. Number one, he'd finish guys off with it. Number two, he went for it two other times and didn't get it. And I'm sure the announcers, I don't speak Japanese, but I'm positive the announcers were telling the story that right. he's been trying to hit this move. And if he gets it, it's over.
Done.
And so the crowd knew to react and to come up with it because that story was being told so well. So yeah, that's how I try to kind of work with things. I treat it like a sport. I treat it like it's UFC, where I'm studying the fighters and try and recall what happened in past matches and things like that.
That's treating it with respect. And this interview, it's getting very niche because you're talking about like Bruce and all that. And like in my head, I'm like, all right, he's talking about the reunion tour while they're doing the big 20-minute 10th Avenue Freeze and all that time. Don't worry. I know where you're at. There might be like two other people listening to this that know exactly what we're talking about, but that's okay because you're from the tri-state area. You're a sports broadcaster. Therefore, by rule of law, you have to be a Springsteen fan. That's how it is with all of us. I get it. But you said something there that was really important to me. And that was, you were saying you're going back, you're watching these matches in preparation, knowing what to do. And for me, that's the single most important thing that any broadcaster can do. And it's the single biggest flaw in, I mean, you can call out, you can, with your eye and with your ear, you can call out an amateur broadcaster immediately because if they're underprepared, they stick out. And Ian Eagle, who's the play-by-play guy for the Brooklyn Nets and CBS National and the NBA on Turner, he's my mentor. I've known Ian for 12 plus years. And the one piece of advice he'd always give me in the beginning of my career was pre-production is production. Preparation is everything. How important is preparation for you when you're calling a wrestling event, and how much time do you spend preparing per show?
That's a great question. I'm going to tell a weird story, but I promise it goes somewhere. In 2006, my dad took a early buyout to retire. He was 50, barely 50.
Wow.
And that was going to be it. And they have the house they live in now is the one that they bought then. It's like $35,000 or $40,000 in the swamps of Florida in Ocala. Yes, we do. We have seen Dory Funk in town there. But they moved down. They sent me to college. They took the buyout and they thought they were ready to retire. They came back in a couple of years. But during that summer, I'd gone down there. My mom had a moped and I was going too fast on the moped. I wrecked the moped. So I lost some of my teeth, got a back concussion. I needed to pass time. It was in between, in my first year at college and my second year at college. And I'd collected autographs when I was a kid. And I used to write, they call it through the mail, autographs. So I wrote to Harry Callis. And Harry Callis was the Hall of Fame broadcaster for the Phillies. And I said, hey, do you have any advice? And he said, be yourself and do your homework. And so similar thing. So right then, I knew that that was key and critical and paramount. And the one feeling you never want to have for a wrestling broadcaster, at least play by play, is when someone hits a move and you know you're supposed to know it and you know there's a name and it's not on your phone, it's not in your notes, you just whiff it and you got to say what a maneuver or this or that. and it's probably something that's really important to the wrestler. And, I've done this before and there's no worse feeling. And it's a feeling that you've let somebody down. It's a feeling that you could have prevented this because it is, it is something that you could have learned by yourself or learned by asking the wrestler. So to me, there's no worse feeling than having that pit in your stomach, especially in wrestling, knowing that you could have added something to the wrestler, to the match. Gorilla Monsoon always used to say that's a patented move. Even before guys had finishers, everybody had like a patented thing they did. And that was their thing. And it didn't always have a name, but when it did, it was really important. And so for me, that's super, super important. So the things I do to prep, I never like to know the outcome of matches. I try and go in blind to everything, literally as much as I can. I literally think about two different ways that I would announce the winner or four different ways, depending if there's four people or what have you. So I always try and have like what I would say to kind of wrap up the match or segment, no matter who wins. And I kind of think about it that way. I go to each wrestler and say, is there anything really important that you're going to do tonight? Is there anything that has a name? Is there anything that's a callback? Because especially in New Japan, and we saw this a lot in Madison Square Garden, Chris Charlton was a part of our team. Now, Chris didn't get a lot of airtime. He didn't say much. He was there to translate for the crowd, but Chris was instrumental because Chris was able to have that kind of conversation because he is fluent in Japanese. He is fluent in English. So he was able to have some of those conversations so that, you know, when there were big matches, he was able to know the callouts, recognize them. And Kevin's a pro. Kevin, same thing. So, you know, we studied in that way. And Chris was able to say, hey, you know what? Last time Tetsuya Naito and Kota Ibushi fought, this, this, and this happened. So if these things happen, it's probably because they're referencing a previous match. And this would be really important if this happened. And so those kind of conversations, they should happen. Tracy Williams used a lot of Doug Williams' offense in the Pure tournament. And I asked him, I said, hey, Tracy, I know your stuff doesn't have a lot of names. Are you going to do anything different today? Yeah, I'm using a lot of Doug Williams moves. Oh, like what? Oh, the Chaos Theory. Oh, this, that. Same thing with Mike Bennett. You know, Mike Bennett against Jonathan Gresham had a lot of different callbacks to Nigel McGuinness, to John Walters, to guys who had been in the Pure division. Those are super critical. And then one of the most fun matches I ever called was that final battle, Violence Unlimited versus the Foundation guys. And they did 8 moves in a row that were just finishers from previous Ring of Honor champions, which was awesome. And I would have missed one or two of them had they told me, to be perfectly honest. And those are ones that, you know, if you're supposed to be the guy that has the authority and the gravitas, you would expect that guy to know them. So those conversations, there's no harm in having those conversations. And if you prefer not to know the outcomes, you can still have that conversation without knowing the outcome.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you brought all that up, because that's exactly what I do for any pro wrestling that I call. I go up to every single person who is on the match, even if I know they got a 3-minute match and they're losing and not getting any offense in. I want to know if there's anything I should get over for them. And you also have to find a way to do it where you're not obviously punching points in your broadcast, so it seems unnatural. You don't want to do that. Well, let me tell you something. It is so appreciated by talent when you make the effort as a broadcaster to go out of the way, because it's showing them I give a shit about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And that really does mean something to a lot of talent. And that's my biggest piece of advice to any broadcaster. I'm so glad that you said the same thing, because I'm sure the talent are very appreciative of that from you.
It's really nice. And that's something we talked about, New Frontiers, and we talked about, I would have been heartbroken had it just kind of ended. And I didn't know if I was ready to try and pick things up and put things back together. I had a couple people reach out right away. Delirious, who I've become great friends with, called right away. Kevin Kelly did, Excalibur did. You know, Excalibur texted me and just reached out and just said, hey, how you doing? Like, you just, what are you going through? What are you feeling? But then when we had tapings 4 days later, and I'm glad they told us before the tapings, because had we gone through, done the tapings, and then they called us, I think that would have been not a great of a move, because they told us we got to kind of celebrate a little. You know, we were there at the hotel for 3 days anyway. We weren't throwing ragers, but I sat around with Chris Hero, ate a cupcake, and watched wrestling. I got to hang out with Kerry a little more. I got to talk to Bobby Cruz more and Todd Sinclair. And, you know, I was hanging out with Matt Taven more. You know, those moments where, you know, you're sitting in your hotel room and you're kind of comfortable and someone's like, oh, come on down, get a, you know, get something to eat with me. That little thing in the back of your head when you know it might be ending goes away. And that little thing of like, oh, I'm comfortable. I'm like, no, you go and see it, because you know this might, there could be a chance that this is the last time. So sure. where I'm going with that is you start to feel more appreciated, because then you have guys walk up to you and say, hey, man, I really liked working with you and I appreciate what you did. And you're able to reciprocate that too, you know. And a lot of times, as the announcer, you know, I'm deep down, I'm a fan. So as much as I can, I'm always saying, "Man, that match was awesome. That was great. I loved it." But you don't always get that back, because it's kind of heat of the moment, and they're focused. They're coming down from the adrenaline. They're coming down, and you never expect it back. You always kind of tell folks what you enjoyed and why you enjoyed it, and you move on. But what was really nice about those tapings and then final battle, was to hear it come back. And, you know, there was a guy that pulled me aside and said, you know, there's only a handful of people that I really trust to call my matches, and you know, and you're one of them, and the other guy's on Wednesday night. And so it's, you know, that meant the world to me to know that, you know, he thinks of me like that. So it's really nice to feel appreciated. And it's really nice that, again, it's that idea of putting in the effort and you're reaching a goal. And if you hit a goal, great. And then this extra stuff where if you continue to try and do it well, there's some cool benefits where you're
I think everything you just said there is so paramount for aspiring broadcasters. And I really hope people take stuff away from everything you just said. And as we wrap up here, I promise you we get to talk about this. So we're going to, it's funny for me, Ian, I have found through my various forms of broadcasting over the years, whether it's anchoring, whether it's doing feature stories, whether it's long form interviewing like this or podcasts, I draw my storytelling inspirations from all different forms of mediums. And that includes music. Both you and I share a commonality in being big Bruce Springsteen fans. And I think Bruce Springsteen is an iconic storyteller. And stuff that I've learned from reading Springsteen's autobiography and listening to his music, I've brought into my broadcasting, including in pro wrestling. And so I find it so funny that you resonate with that as well. So we'll run down the quick Bruce checklist here. If any of our fans don't like this too bad, because we're going to get to talk shop with the boss. All right. Favorite Springsteen album. What is it?
Oh goodness. Wild, the Innocent, the E Street Shuffle.
Wild, the Innocent. Favorite song off the Wild and the Innocent.
Oh geez. Oh man. I got to go Rosalita just because it's,
You know, I've seen Bruce probably 30 plus times. I have had Vinny Mad Dog Lopez back me up like on stage, and I've never heard Rosalita live. Is that unbelievable or what?
I haven't either. I've seen him seven times. Seven times, okay. I've seen Frankie, which he never plays. Oh, I've seen Frankie twice. I've seen Zero and Blind Terry. I saw that on the acoustic tour. I've seen just weird stuff
that's crazy.
On tracks on that. I've never heard Rosalita. I've heard, I've heard Thundercrack several times.
Nice. Several times. So that's like 25 minutes combined of songs, just hearing it twice. So that's okay. Yeah. Got it. All right, favorite Springsteen song, period.
Santa Ana.
Wow.
Yeah, that you talk about storytelling. It's just a beautiful song. You know, it's just this whimsical kind of journey through the desert. You know, he wrote it when he was going back and forth to California, and he went down to Mexico, and never made an album. It got onto tracks, but it's one of my favorites, and I love it.
Oh, some of my favorite Springsteen songs are off tracks and deep cut stuff too. I played a Springsteen tribute show at the Wonder Bar in Asbury Park one time, and we got to pick six songs to play, and I just said to my buddy, I was like, listen, I don't care what we play, but there's two songs we need, because I just love deep cuts. We got to play Lion's Den, and we got to play Roll of the Dice off Human Touch.
Oh, wow.
I think Roll of the Dice is an incredible storytelling song. You talk about that too. Okay, fun stuff there. Let's see, favorite Springsteen lyric.
Oh, geez. Oh, wow. I got to think about this one.
I just gave you Born to Run, which I seriously, I'm not exaggerating when I say I live by that mantra. Someday, I don't know when we're going to get to that place. That's kind of my calling card. It's what keeps me going, but that's not my favorite Springsteen lyric, though.
I'm really always touched by Good Luck, Goodbye, Bobby Jean. And
goodbye,
I don't. It's just this kind of coping, like whenever I need to cope with something, I put on Bobby Jean, and I know it's about him and Stevie. And it's one of these things where I think we've all kind of fell in and out with our best friend, or someone we love. And it's just that kind of final resignation. And I think it's because I know there's a happy ending. And I always really liked Talk to Me, which was made more famous by
Southside Johnny.
I got a full week's pay, and I'm working hard each day. It's that that reminds me of being a teenager. That reminds me of driving to Asbury Park, going to the Stone Pony, going to see Gary U.S. Bonds, going to see Jody Josephs, and hoping that Bruce shows up. It never happened to me, but I've run into Mad Dog Lopez. I've run into Bon Jovi multiple times down there, but I never got to, never ran into the boss down there.
Well, Bruce Springsteen nearly ran me over with his car once, and that's a whole nother story that you can go back and listen to in the archives here on Ad Free Shows. Here's me on the stage of the Pony, just rocking it. Just an iconic venue there, man. I think my favorite lyric, and you talk about imagery, and this plays into broadcasting too. Imagery is so important, especially if you're calling radio. Imagery is everything. And that would be A Dream of Life Comes to Me Like a Catfish Dancing on the End of My Line from The Rising. I just think that's one of the most incredible imagery lyrics he ever wrote. So good stuff there, man. Well, you and I will definitely have to check out a Springsteen show at some point. You know, I'm back in Jersey now. You're not far out there, so we'll have to make sure once this letter to you tour kicks off at some point, hopefully soon, someday, I don't know when, Ian, we're going to get to that place, and that place is going to be the stadium. I'm going to be hanging out with you, whether it's at a wrestling show, whether it's at Hammerstein Ballroom for GCW, which I'm so excited for you to call, or any Springsteen show, whatever it may be. I'm so excited for what's next for you. You're an outstanding broadcaster, and I think there's a lot of aspiring broadcasters who will listen to this interview and pick up something, and I hope they do. Anything else you'd like to add, man, about what's next and what people should take away from your journey?
Man, I'm just so thankful right now. It's a blessing to be associated for as long as I have been with Ring of Honor. And I've told anybody that'll listen, if we come back in April, sign me up. I want to be a part of it. For me, though, I've just been flattered and kind of flabbergasted by the outpouring of folks that saying, hey, you know, if you're really attached to Ring of Honor, give, you know, if so-and-so wants to bring you in, try it. Try. And, you know, for GCW to reach out, who's on top of the world right now, New Japan, who's always been, you know, the biggest and the best wrestling. And then another company reached out. So I don't know when this is going to drop. It may have already been announced by then, but there's a mystery company involved, and I'll be calling some stuff for them, coming up in different outlets and venues. And it's a company that I've watched for a while, and I really like them. And So we'll see how that works. And I'm just so flattered that they've reached out and that I got permission from Ring of Honor. I was heartbroken when we said that we're going to have a hiatus. None of us really still know what that means. And they've been keeping in good contact with us and trying to keep us informed each step of the way about what's next at this step. But if, if my time in Ring of Honor is over, which I don't believe it is in my heart, but we'll see, then at least I got to do some other cool stuff along the way. So I'll never take that for granted. I'll never take for granted walking out Madison Square Garden, seeing Bruce, seeing his picture, coming out of the Rangers locker room and going through the tunnel there. And it was a really cool moment. And so there are things that I'll enjoy forever. You know, seeing my 1-year-old at the time, he was 1 year old, Zach, going to All In, having the time of his life with Scott Steiner and Jeff Jarrett and all these, just stuff like that I'll never forget. And Conrad not knowing what to do with a 1-year old was hilarious. And I'm in front of the 1-year old. So, just those kind of moments and memories. I'm hoping to have more of them. And Hammerstein Ballroom coming up January 23rd is going to be huge date. And I'm excited to call Jonathan Gresham's title, although he might not have the belt by then. He's defending against Chris Sabin. He's defending against AJ Gray. He's defending against Too Cold Scorpio. So who knows? It might be Too Cold Scorpio versus Blake Christian.
Dude, wrestling is so weird right now. Joey Janela is facing Scotty Too Hottie. Like, wrestling is just wild right now. So, hey, man, I'm so appreciative that you took time to hang out with us here on One-on-One with John Abel. Again, you guys can catch it every single Thursday, dropping early on adfreeshows.com and 7 p.m. Eastern on AFS on YouTube.com. He is Ian Riccaboni. We're so grateful for you, my man. Wishing you all the best. A happy new year to you. And we'll see you guys next time here on One-on-One with John Alba. Happy new year to all of you watching. We'll see you next time.